Jerry Brown has just a few more days as governor of California. He talked with Cap Radio's Ben Adler recently about issues that he took on and those he didn't or couldn't, in his view. On Insight, you're going to hear some of that conversation. It was recorded at the Browns Ranch in Colusa. Monday's college football national championship game at Levi Stadium will be dedicated to helping teachers from Butte County who lost their homes and classrooms in the campfire. The district superintendent, Tim Taylor, is here to talk about what's planned. With him is a teacher from France who's presenting donations that her students raised for the people in Paradise. Later in the hour, memories of UC Davis's Freeborn Hall, which will be demolished as announced recently. Robin Fox from the KDVS Saturday Morning Folk Show will join me with sound advice. I'm Beth Ruriak. That's Today on Insight. First, the news. From Capital Public Radio in Sacramento, this is Insight. I'm Beth Ruriak. California Governor Jerry Brown is 80 years old. He has been governor twice, with 28 years in between. And each time, as most of you know, he was reelected to a second term. Monday, though, this era of the Jerry Brown governorship ends. The governor and his wife, Anne, will officially transition to their new home, which has been built on family land in Colusa. That's about an hour northwest of Sacramento. And that's where Cap Radio's Capital Bureau Chief Ben Adler spent some time with the governor recently. They went to the ranch, and Ben is here to share some of that conversation. Welcome. Glad to have you in the studio.
Good morning. Happy New Year.
This is a conversation and a situation that we knew we'd be coming to. I like the fact that he invited you to join him on the ranch. So set the scene a little bit in that wide open space.
It is a beautiful open space in the rolling foothills of Colusa County, about 20 minutes west of Williams off the I-5. And it's, you know, it was nice to be up there after it had rained. So it was green, right, and it smelled fresh. It was cold. And it was, you have a situation where we were looking on Google Maps and the street view, and it showed two barns heavily graffitied, and they looked terrible. Well, that's out of date, and it may be intentional that Google Street View hasn't updated that, but right now you've got three beautifully renovated barns, a couple of tiny cottages, that one of which the governor spent the night in while he was building his house along with First Lady and Gus Brown. They have a guest house, and they have the house that they live in now, which is very large, a very large open space for the family room and the living room and the dining room, kitchen, and then just one bedroom. Everyone else has to sleep at the guest house, except the dogs, of course, Colusa Brown and Callie Brown, who joined the governor and me and our crew for the interview, which we began by sitting inside, talking about policies, in particular, because we've heard from the governor in his NPR exit interview a lot about what he did accomplish. I wanted to ask him about some of the things that maybe didn't get done on his watch.
So we're going to hear the first of two parts of the interview, one being this indoor segment and another being outdoors. You're going to hear Ben's voice first, so let's listen.
You've always been very intentional, at least this go around, in picking your battles. You chose not to take a deeper look at tax reform, even though you've acknowledged the state needs it.
I've had a very deep look at tax reform. That's why I think I have a very clear understanding.
Of why you chose not to tackle it this time?
Of why I don't believe the legislature wants to tackle it, or why I don't think the people want to tackle it. And if given the opportunity in subsequent years, I think what I've said will be proven out. There are problems that aren't always amenable to simple solutions. And there's a lot of talk about tax reform, and actually it's really tax change, because from the day the first tax was enacted, there's always subsequent tax changes. Some of them are called reforms, and some are called loopholes, and some are called other things. But there's no nice way to tax. So people can look at it, and they may come up with a few things. But I have looked deeply into the nature of our current taxes, and I don't think there's a quick major change. I think there's little nibbling around the edges. You can do that. There's always more, which is usually what it is, not less. So based on that, I would say that's not a very fruitful area for gubernatorial leadership.
You also called CEQA reform the Lord's work, and that you've never met a CEQA exemption you didn't like, talking about the California Environmental right. Quality Act, which critics, including you, have said can make it harder to build. But you chose, I think, not to tackle that.
When you say chose, you might say, do you choose to, levitate off your chair? Well, that's not possible. So in the CEQA arena, you have two very powerful forces, building trades and environmentalists. And those two forces are going to block any particular change. Now, you might go to the initiative and spend many millions of dollars, but that would then interfere with other priorities and would also engage in battles that would then block others. And then you have to ask me, well, why didn't you do that other thing that got blocked? Because you went after the CEQA. So the point I would make, you cannot do everything all the time. That's not life. You're not in Sacramento today. You're out here in Rancho Veneta. So we choose, and to choose is to go to one spot instead of another. And that's what I would say on the CEQA front. I don't see any way of making major changes. And I did try some changes, but they get even the small changes were watered down before they got enacted. So I'd say that's one of the conditions of contemporary government in California.
And I ask because you leave office having accomplished quite a bit, and the state's fiscal shape is strong, but there are, as you know, many Californians who struggle to afford living in California. And between the end of redevelopment agencies early in your term to help balance the budget, and the lack of changes in the development process to make it easier and quicker to develop, there are folks who argue that, you know, this happened on your watch, that this...
Wait, what's the it?
Oh, that what happened on your watch? That California's...
Well, what was the it? That home prices got more expensive?
California's housing affordability crisis has deepened.
Housing prices
and
got
poverty
more
has
expensive.
Deepened. Yeah, yeah. And to what extent were you as governor responsible?
I bet your house got more has a higher value now than when you bought it.
But okay, so
why don't we cut it in half and make it more affordable? No, nobody wants to do that. All right, here's what happened. We closed the deficit. And that $27 billion that is now not a deficit, but is basically a surplus, that happened because of the capitalist growth machine, exemplified by Silicon Valley, by tourism, by agriculture, by the movie industry. All these things have generated almost $1 trillion in new wealth. That drives willing buyers to push the price up, and the willing sellers are only too happy to sell. And that buying and selling in our free society functions exactly the way it did. It has an upside, but it also has a downside. And the downside is that housing in California for many people is not affordable, and we have all the issues that people have remarked on. But I would still say there's a lot of opportunity in this state, and that's why people come here. They don't come here because it's bad. They come here because it's good. And that's one of the dilemmas. I found that in Oakland, that as new money poured into Oakland and condominiums and new buildings were built, then people said, wait a minute, that's gentrifying. But before we had those investments, We had blight, we had downtown with virtually no restaurants, no vitality, and now we do. So unfortunately, the good often comes with the bad. The day is followed by night, and I think that the coming recession will bring down the price of your house and other houses, and that will make things more affordable, but I don't know that it will make people more happy.
You've been credited with taking California from a $27 billion deficit to a what the nonpartisan legislative analyst says is a $23 billion surplus as you leave office. The state budget also grew on your watch from $87 billion general fund in 2011 to $133 billion this final fiscal year, an increase of more than 50%. There's obviously still, although you took some steps to try to tackle the pension liabilities and retiree health liabilities, there are some still there. What would you say to some Californians who might argue that the
you don't deserve as much of the reputation for fiscal prudence that you often get credited with.
Well, I would say anybody who wants to talk about legacies and reputation, I would be only too happy to agree. When you have a state that increases its wealth by $800 billion in 8 years, you have to expect that government will be a part of that. In fact, government helps cause some of that wealth, but more schooling, more roads, more health care, more child care, more investment in water projects, all of that is what government is. And the idea that we could have a vastly increased wealth with all the problems we have in terms of social problems, environmental problems, and not try to spend some of the money is almost unthinkable. And the only other way around it would be to return tax money. Then you would have a recession and you'd have to increase the taxes, which is exactly what Reagan did. He gave money back and then he raised the taxes. And then, so it becomes kind of a ping pong. So I've tried to put it on a steady keel, and I think you can appreciate all that in the next couple of years, because I would venture to say the budgets will grow, and they'll grow particularly because there's so much money. And then after that, they will be cut because we'll be in a recession. And it's that ebb and flow, that rhythm of life that defines all of us as we try to make the best of it.
That is outgoing California Governor Jerry Brown in conversation with Cap Radio's Capital Bureau Chief Ben Adler. Ben is in the studio with me. It's interesting to hear him lay out in one conversation this idea that the growth in California came at a price, that if you're going to have an increase in many factors of the economy, the growth overall, the surplus is going to go up, that it comes at a cost, and there's going to be the cause and effect. And it almost seemed, in his view, that he didn't think both the circumstance of growth in the state and a prospering populace could exist at the same time.
He's been known to speak of the difference between problems and conditions. Problems like a budget deficit you have to solve. Conditions will always, in his mind, be there. He takes the longer view, right? The ebb and the flow, the rhythm of life. Mm-hmm. Day follows night. The seasons change. And one way or another, California is going to have a solid budget surplus, or at least a stable budget situation when the economy is strong, some deficits when the economy is poor. The housing market might be a little more affordable when the economy isn't doing so well, but then the housing prices really explode when the economy booms. So he takes the longer view on that, and he tends to point to that as one of the reasons for this big issue that really did develop on his watch, even as he just said, tried to stabilize the budget so that maybe the next recession won't include quite such a big financial crisis.
Something he said earlier was interesting to me, and I'm writing it down as something to watch as the Newsom administration steps into the governorship. Governor Brown said there are problems that aren't amenable to simple solutions. You had asked him about tax reform, and he said it's not a fruitful area for gubernatorial leadership. Mm-hmm. I think he was speaking to the complexity of it. But he's also saying that one person alone isn't going to stake their legacy or their success as a governor on the issue of tax reform. Is that how you heard it?
Yeah, I think not so much the legacy. We spent 6 minutes arguing or going back and forth on whether on the word legacy and how it would or wouldn't apply to him. And we didn't put that part on the air. But certainly about political success, he has to choose his battles. That got to the basis of my first question, is he chose very intentionally what he was going to try to take on and what he was not going to try to take on. He managed, I think just one example would be a lot of times he went after some of the state government unions on pensions and local government unions on the pension issue. I never really saw him truly take on the California Teachers Association, less mm-hmm. so on pensions and less so on other areas, other budget issues and the like. And I think that's one example of how he chose his battles. He decided which allies do I want in my corner? I mean, look, he was a politician. He is a politician. He's just been around the block. He's made all of his mistakes, and he knows what the limits are of his power and how to maximize his power. And that was what he sought to do.
Your conversation at the ranch continued with him outside. I like that idea of thinking about him out on the farmland and this kind of transition out of the state capitol to what he's going to do. So that's where we're going to hear the next segment of the conversation.
Yes, we went outside, and we, being myself and our photographer Andrew Nixon and our producer Nadine Sabai and our digital producer Emily Zentner, we all hopped on a couple of golf carts along with the governor's staff and CHP patrol, and Jerry Brown was driving the golf cart that I was on, and Calusa and Callie Brown were riding shotgun, and off we went.
It's a very different life than the life you've led over the last couple of decades, and a different change of pace. So what makes you want it?
Well, one thing, I was talking to my uncle, Harold, who was my father's brother, and he was a lawyer, and he knew the family history better than anybody. And he always said, you know, I made a mistake. I should have been a farmer. And he liked this land. He knew the history. He knew the his cousins that lived here, which I didn't really know. I know them now, but I didn't know it then. And so I thought, man, there's something about that, going back to the land. And then at some point I came across that picture of my great-grandfather, August Shuckman, with his white beard, feeding the sheep and the chickens around. And I thought to myself, that's not a bad place to be when one is 80. So I said, that's where I'm coming. So that's what I did. And I wanted to build a house here. And that's how I asked my mother to give my father's share and of the ranch. And then we got this little section, which is my personal. My wife and I own this 25 acres. Personally, the rest is owned by the family and a family corporation.
And you're going to buy a car, do your own grocery shopping, do your own
driving?
Well,
we have bought a car. Ann bought a car yesterday. She'll be driving it up.
What is it?
It's a Pacifica, a hybrid, electric.
You ready for this? You ready to be out of the governor's office?
Well, ask me that when we get out of here. So you're always asking these anticipation questions. I very much... It's interesting. Talking to you is actually interesting. So I'm so absorbed in that, I'm not thinking when you're gone, what am I going to think? But I will think when you're gone.
But I mean, you said you're going to have...
Are we going to go?
You're not having a retirement. You're having an active life.
Well, because there's a lot. First of all, this ranch has got lots to do. Just learning how to make that olive oil, finding out when to pick it, how much water to use, how to get make sure it doesn't get diseased. That's a big deal. Then I'm on the chairman of the new the Bulletin of Atomic Scientists. I mean, a number of things that I'm going to be doing.
So Gavin Newsom's going to take over a state with lots of money that you think he should stash away.
Lots of money that is only temporary.
Exactly.
Because it's not like the money stays there.
He's campaigned on universal health care.
By the way, it's not even clear the money will be there, because it's a prediction over the next 18 months. It's the budget reserves for the budget starting in June, going for another year. So what will happen? You know, you see the stock market the last week. So that's why I'm always on guard for the downturn and trying to prevent that.
So we know that your advice to Governor-elect Newsom is to think of the worst thing that could possibly happen
and then do everything you can
to prevent it. Yeah. You've known him all his life. You've known his family.
Known him all his life. I've known his father all my life. But I didn't know Gavin because he was born after I'd moved to Los Angeles. But I have got to know him a little bit.
So you've known the Governor-elect for a few years. Yes, and you led Oakland as he led San Francisco across the bay. What do you like about him? Does he ever do things that get on your nerves that make you concerned about?
Not as much as you.
Gavin will be glad to hear that.
No, I think the point, Gavin comes from a politically interested family. His father was interested in politics. His grandfather was certainly very helpful to my father in the early years when he was running for the district attorney of San Francisco. So, and he himself has that interest. And given the fact that he was a supervisor and a mayor in a very contentious, diverse city, I think he's got a good amount of experience in the kind of contention and issues that he'll find in Sacramento. So I think that that's a very good preparation. That in fact, I did not have that preparation. I was Secretary of State, which is a quiet office compared to the mayor of San Francisco. So I think that and the fact that he's been lieutenant governor now and on the Lands Commission, he's had a good acquaintanceship. But having said all that, he'll have his hands full because the interest groups, both left and right, are very eager to test the new governor and to get as much money, as many laws and regulations as they possibly could. And the governor, in keeping with the notion of what a governor is, it's to hold the rate of change to a certain level. That's what governors do. A governor and an engine keeps the engine from running out of control. And that's exactly what the governor has to do.
Well, how
in terms
confident
of
are you that, that Governor Newsom will be able to do that?
Well, I think only time will tell. I don't operate in the prophecy business like you pundits are so attracted to.
You have talked at times about things you might have done differently in your first stint as governor, criminal justice reform and criminal justice laws and perhaps Prop 13. You said maybe you spent a little too much time running for president. I wonder if there's anything that you would have done differently in this stint as governor, or if you're
no,
in
I can't. Yeah, if you could have the 8 years and counterfactual, you could go back and do it again. You'd have all that extra experience. But not having that ability, I would say what I did, I did. Now, can you imagine, in hindsight, would you do something different? I don't know. You'd have to. That's an imaginary exercise that you'd have to decide for each particular item. And I nothing strikes me right now. I'm sure that things always have more than one way to do things. I mean, there's more than one way to skin a cat. So if we want to think about it, oh, maybe we could have done something different. But just as I see it right now, I'd said what we did, what I did, what happened. I think, by and large, it was I think it was pretty successful, and I wouldn't have any real changes at this point. But if he gave me enough time, I'm sure I could figure something I might have done differently.
Is your political career over, or Colusa County Supervisor?
I don't know. I don't see. Those are what I put into your prophecy, future fortune telling mode, and I don't find that very helpful. I find right now exciting, even talking to you. So how in the world can I think about something that isn't even in front of me? But I don't rule anything out, and I don't rule anything in.
I'm trying to pay attention to the points he's making, but I got really caught up in the relationship the two of you have. And it's a reminder that with the Capitol Press Corps, you spend a lot of time with a head of state or the leadership. And over the years, of course, you two have this relationship. He teases you. I'm not seeing the expression on his face, but when he says you annoy him more than Gavin Newsom.
He doesn't like certain questions. No politician likes certain questions. Jerry Brown, I think, feels more free to express that sentiment than others with future ambitions, perhaps.
How much has it mattered to try to get along with him? You need to cover him. We need to hear from him through you, through the press corps. Do you try to have a relationship, and what kind?
Well, I mean, that's a complicated question. It's not my job to get along with anyone I cover. It's my job to tell the story, to report on what we see and what is going on in our state, because everything that's happening here is so important, particularly given California's adversarial role with the president. But, you know, he is an interesting person to cover. Tomorrow, I've got a fun story on Morning Edition and All Things Considered with Brownism, so some of his more colorful quotes. And it was just a fun chance to empty out the reporter's notebook. But, you know, we all know that he says entertaining things. What's less known is he can get pretty combative with questions and push back and be a little prickly, as we heard in that interview, which brings to mind a fun little reporter's notebook that Adam Nagurny of The New York Times wrote, which I just linked to on my Twitter at Adler Ben. Tips for interviewing Jerry Brown. For one, it's not a good idea to use the word legacy in asking about the California governor's legacy. And that was how I started the interview intentionally. I kind of poked California's grizzly bear a little bit, but it is always entertaining. And we will be certainly ending an era on Monday when Governor-elect Gavin Newsom takes the oath of office. Hmm.
So much to say. We'll talk later about all these prophecy, fortune-telling, futuristic anticipation questions that you ask, okay?
Maybe you can get out to the ranch and not be quite as rushed and be able to cover a little more ground.
That's great. All right, more to come from Ben Adler. You can find more at capradio.org. Thanks to you, Nadine, Andrew, Emily, for the trip out there and for what you were able to share with us as this governor leaves the office in California.
And we've got much more tomorrow and Monday leading up to the inauguration.
Governor Brown's term does officially end Monday. Gavin Newsom will be sworn in, and you can hear more and follow the coverage of that inauguration here on Cap Radio. Coverage begins Monday at 9 a.m. Thanks again, Ben.
You're welcome.
You're listening to Insight on Cap Radio. You're listening to Insight on Cap Radio. I'm Beth Ruyak. Monday evening at Levi Stadium in Santa Clara, the Clemson Tigers will meet the Alabama Crimson Tide in the College Football National Championship game. Okay, well, that's great for all you sports fans, but listen to this. Revenue from that game will be donated to the Butte County teachers who lost their homes and their classrooms in the campfire in November. And those teachers, along with other top teachers from across the state, are going to be honored in a special ceremony. So this continues to be an intense and an emotional time of recovery for the people of Butte County, for that town of paradise and the surrounding area. In the studio with me is the superintendent of schools, Tim Taylor, who has usually been a guest by phone. I'm really glad he's here with us in person. Tim, thank you so much for the ongoing conversation that we've been able to have.
And thanks for having us. We really appreciate it.
Also with him all the way from Provence, France, is teacher Erica Plazinet. And she's going to explain why she's here in just a moment. But let me welcome you, Erica, to Northern California and to Insight.
Thank you. Pleasure to be here.
So, Tim, the schools are back now after the holiday break. Are students back in?
Monday.
Monday they will be. All right. Tell me how everybody navigated the start to school just before the holidays and then the return that will happen.
Yeah, I think the overall it went well. We lost about 45% of the kids did not come back at that point. Either they had moved or were still looking for housing. But overall, it went great. I think all the different towns of Chico, Oroville, and Durham really accepted as many kids as they could accept and take. Over the holidays, we've placed dozens of portables, so the kids now have more interim, temporary, nice settings versus sharing classrooms. I think we had one kindergarten class over in Durham that had about 70 kids in it with five teachers. And only teachers can pull that off, and they did a great job. But they're all looking forward to having their own classrooms in temporary portables starting on Monday.
You and I spoke by phone a little bit yesterday, and we were talking about preschool. And you said in particular there is some need focused on preschool. Would you expand on that, and are there ways people can help?
Yeah, I think in our preschool, the preschool world, we lost a lot of preschool slots up in Paradise, and so we had to scramble to find places. But those are the parents, I think, you know what it's like when your kids are under, they're 3-4 years old.
Yeah.
And the system is not the same as K-12. I think Governor Newsom's going to come in and I think really push to have preschool for all. So it's a hodgepodge of state preschools, Head Starts, and private preschools that don't have places for kids to go right after the fire. And we're looking for more places for them. But they had a lot of them lost everything, the parents and everything. So I'm really pushing now to get the early learning students and the preschools support and help, because it's not in the K-12 quote-unquote system, mm-hmm. which has a lot more funding and support. And our director, Heather Sinsky's, worked very closely to build a foundation specifically for the preschools, and I can send you the link for that, to help those parents with their social needs, emotional needs, because they went through the same things as the K-12 system. They just don't have quite the same full system that we see with the high schools and middle schools.
Parents of that age group need a lot of support anyway, in the most ideal circumstances, because oftentimes you're just learning how to parent. You're going through a lot of developmental stages rapidly. And I think the school system supports a whole family in that way.
Yeah, and I think most of the parents that are in our preschool program are on, they're definitely below the poverty line. State preschools, there's a certain income level that you stay under. So it's our poorest parents who have the most needs, and our first five up there and all that are doing the best they can. But it's definitely an area where we could continue to use help to support them and give them resources to get back on their feet.
Erica, let me bring you into the conversation. Will you tell me a bit about your school in Provence, the age group of your students, and how you came to feel such an empathy and connection for what was happening in Paradise?
Sure. Well, our school is called the International Bilingual School of Provence. We're located in Aix-en-Provence, about 20 minutes from Marseille. We have a K through 12 and also a preschool. We have over 70 nationalities at our school, so the majority are American kids, a lot of boarding students as well. And when this these fires happened in California in November, I just had so many of my students asking me about my family or my friends and if everything's okay. And also a lot of my students who said they had some kind of connection to California, either they had lived here or they had family here. It was just a recurring conversation that kept coming back, also from colleagues that I work with who are also American. And so I decided that also, well, also I must say in France, they have done quite a few reports on those fires on the local news. So a lot of people have been concerned and informed about it. So I just started to think about what we could do to get involved, because I saw that so many of the kids were interested, and also because of the teachers that I could feel for losing their schools and their homes. So we decided to try and do some kind of small fundraiser just to make a point, just so my kids could feel like they had a connection, could help. And it's gone from there. I've made this great connection with Mr. Taylor to be here today. So I'm just really happy about that.
Well, she's being very humble. When we got her email, we were taken back, right? So when saw that she had a bake sale, by the way, the kids back there look like they use better butter than we do. Their cookies look fantastic. But I think that connection as a teacher to a teacher is what you see with firemen to firemen and police to police when there's a tragedy. And there's been some teachers who've stepped far above and beyond, like Erica, to really support them, because I think there's a kindred, you know, spirit between those two teachers that is very powerful.
For my students and then also for teachers, because I just can't imagine losing my classroom, losing my school and my home at the same time and still going to work the following days. It's amazing. It's something that's definitely a passion for teachers, and I respect them and so happy to show, like I said, my students back in France, the resilience that comes from this, from our communities here, because that's not something we can always see.
Do you have a specific connection to this area?
I don't have a specific connection other than my mother lived in Chico when she was younger, so I do have that connection. I feel more connected to Northern California. But I just was really touched when I saw all the fires and the things that happened in the reports. It just really struck me. And I looked for something that we could do. And I found the Butte County Schools Fire Fund. And that seemed to be the perfect connection between what we could make some kind of difference.
Erica Plazanet is here from Provence, France, and she has brought with her donations from her students to the Butte County School District, the students and teachers in the Paradise area. Tim Taylor is here. He's the superintendent of schools, a voice that's become familiar going back to the Oroville Dam crisis and a number of situations that have moved or temporarily or permanently displaced people in the area. So, Tim, in terms of focusing on teachers who lost everything and are absolutely heroic in the way they have put together and reorganized a school system for students, Monday night is really amazing to be honored at the college football national championship game. How did that happen and what will happen Monday night?
Yeah, again, I think we have a really good relationship with the 49ers, and it was kind of a connection between them. They got us to the Pac-12 title game, and then out of the blue, the College Playoff Football Foundation, which does all the national title games, reached out and said, we're going to select you this year as the charity. And so it's super overwhelming. The teachers that are coming are going to have the time of their life. I am going down starting tomorrow through Monday and get on stage before concerts and say, hey, whip out your cell phone and text, and $10 will go to the teachers. But I think it's a really good time to kick off the new year for the teachers, who will be ambassadors for all the teachers. We'll be highlighted in the second quarter. I think we're going on the field with the 50 state teachers of the year all throughout the country. Going to be a great day, and really, really appreciative of the CFP.
The text to donate opportunity that has been set up is active right now. It's going to remain open through the end of the game, which starts at 5:00 on Monday night, January 7th. So you can donate by texting the word teacher to a phone number, which is 56512. We'll put this on our website, but again, the number is 56512. Text the word teacher, and you can make your contribution that goes to Butte County, California. The revenue from that game, everything that's generated that night, is this going to be directed then to the schools and the reorganization of taking care of students?
Yeah, this particular money, because the CFP is about teachers. So Tony Thurman's been asked to join us. We will work directly with the teachers. They've given me a laundry list of what they want. And we'll see how much is available, and so they can get back on their feet. It goes anything from shelving to some new technology and general support. And then I would say the most I'm getting, again, Beth, is emotional support. I think they're going to need ongoing support as they deal with their children and themselves. And so that will be geared towards that also.
Erica, that's where you making the trip is not only the donations that you're bringing from your students, the cookies that were baked, the sales and the messages, but it is, as Tim just said, and he's expressed this to us before on the phone, that understanding that people all over the world are supporting and in the process of time, not forgetting either that this struggle is going to be lifelong for people.
Yes, yes, it is very important because the school that I'm at, we're very lucky that we're able to have a beautiful school that was built not long ago and appreciate it and enjoy it. And to know that it could be gone in a matter of a couple hours, that's the thing that I wanted to be sure that my students understood, and they do. And it has been a constant conversation. It has been a constant effort. And I'm just really proud of them because they really have connected and, like you said, to be starting 2019 with a message of hope and resilience, that's the most important thing. Like you said, these teachers, they're heroes. They're true heroes to go back.
Yeah, and Beth, I think you and I should go do a live show in Provence.
Yes.
Go see your school. What do you think?
I'm all for it.
Okay.
I think there's a relationship here of sister schools brewing or sister cities brewing.
No, I think, and the kids in her school's outside of Marseille, and it's like in a rural area too. So one of the things that the kids from Paradise will need, and also our North State period, is more of an international relationship. Our school's our sister school with Sac's great, but we're definitely going to work with Erica to adopt some schools up there and really so they can zoom in and talk to each other. It'd be fun.
Yes. And also to know that, like you said, that the support is international. We think about them and all the way in France, we would say that we support you.
How much money was raised through the bake sales, the other efforts at your school?
Well, so far we've had a bake sale for 3 weeks and we raised $500. So it wasn't largest amount that we could. But now we have a lot of letters to give to Paradise students and hopefully, like you said, to continue with our support.
Did you see pictures of the cookies?
I saw pictures of the students and pictures of the cookies. Oh, gosh, we have a lot. They're gorgeous.
I didn't get one yet. So.
I'm also going to mention that we'll post a link to buttecountyrecovers.org. That's a good website for information, for updates in the recovery afterward. And again, Monday night's college football national championship game at Levi Stadium will be honoring these teachers. Thank you for the ongoing dialogue and the opportunity to help connect all of us to what's happening there, Tim. And this is a story that's going to be written, as I said, for the rest of our lives.
It will be. And thanks again for reaching out for the preschool. I really appreciate that and welcome a conversation with our preschool division if you want to talk to what they're going through. It's very interesting.
Well, I think the point was made that if there are any locations out there that are possible for a preschool, that to somehow connect and maybe we can make a bridge somewhere.
Absolutely.
Where one is needed. Mm-hmm. Erica, thank you very much for being here. That's Erica Plazanet. Happy New Year to you, too. And, of course, Tim, Happy New Year to everybody there. Tim Taylor from Butte County School Superintendent's Office. This is Insight on CAP Radio. Listening to Insight on CAP Radio. I'm Beth Ruyak. UC Davis has been wrestling with what to do with its historic concert venue, Freeborn Hall. Finally, in December, after cost analysis and more, the school announced that the hall would be demolished. At what point is uncertain right now. But this week's sound advice is a bit of a memory tour for Robin Fox from KDVS. She is co-host of the Saturday Morning Folk Show, and KDVS is housed right now in Lower Freeborn Hall, soon to be displaced. Hi, Robin.
Welcome. Hi, Ben.
Glad to have you here. You saw a concert at Freeborn Hall that actually, as I understand, inspired significant decisions about your future.
It really did. Freeborn Hall holds a lot of memories for me. KDVS has been there since 1968, I believe. There's a lot of oral history involved. But the concert happened in 1978. I was a 17-year-old freshman at UC Davis. To say I was green would be an understatement. And I was living with my sisters, not in the dorms. The three of us were living together because it was cheaper. And the announcement came out in the Aggie that Pete Seeger was coming. And my sister said, "You want to go?" And I said, "How much is it?" $350. "Oh, yeah." And it was sold out. There were 2,000 of us here. He had us all involved. It was just him on stage with his guitar, banjo, and a recorder. Mm-hmm. And it was a powerful experience. It was wonderful.
Let's get your memory jogged a little more with a little bit of music. Here is Garden Song by Pete Seeger.
Inch by inch, row by row, gonna make this garden grow. Gonna mulch it deep and low. Gonna make it fertile ground. Inch by inch, row by row, please bless these seeds I sow. Please keep them safe below till the rains come tumbling down. Pulling weeds, picking stones, we are made of dreams.
That song was special because he introduced it and said, this is a brand new song. I only heard it in the last couple of months. And of course, being Pete, he had all of us singing along on the chorus. But it became a hit in the folk world anyway. John Denver sang it on The Muppet Show. The man who wrote it was David Mallet, and he's from Maine. Pete changed the lyrics slightly. So whenever I think of that song, I think of Pete's lyrics, not the ones that might be better known in the world from the John Denver performance or others, or even the way David Mallet performs it himself. I think of Pete's and how it was a brand new song in October of 1978. And it has gone all over the world since then.
That inspired your interest in folk music, didn't it?
It did. I grew up with it. I grew up with hearing the Kingston Trio and the Limelighters and the Irish Rovers. But Pete opened the door. And then we found out about the Saturday morning folk show on KDVS and started listening to it every Saturday. And because it's been on for that long. And I would listen to the show with a notepad and write down the names of the songs and what to look for. And then every so often, concerts came to Freeborn Hall.
There was no choice but that you were going to end up a DJ at that show.
I don't know.
I think you sound so dedicated and pure about your love of it and your roots in the area.
It really is an avocation. Mm-hmm. And I've told people I'm an autodidact because I don't think a Pete Seeger concert or any of the other concerts I've been to where the performers talk about the history of the song and the ethnomusicology of what they were doing, of their repertoire, that's not going to show up very well on a college transcript.
Let's continue these memories of Freeborn Hall. Let's just play a clip of music, see if it jogs anyone else's memory, and then you can tell the story.
I'd love that.
Kilkelly, Ireland, 1860, my dear and loving son John. Your good friend, the schoolmaster, Pat McNamara, so good as to write these words down. Your brothers have all gone to find work in England, the house is so empty and sad. The crop of potatoes is sorely infected, a third to a half of them bad. And your sister Bridget.
That was Robbie O'Connell on lead vocal from an album he did with Mick Maloney and Jimmy Cain called Kilkelly. It's a title cut. And that song was taken from a series of letters between a father in Ireland and his son who had emigrated to the States. And Mick Maloney and Robbie O'Connell and Jimmy Cain, along with Eileen Ivers and the Sullis guy. Now the name escapes me.
I can't help
He
you
was
there.
Only 16. He was 16 and already an award-winning musician. Mm-hmm. They came as at the Green Fields of America tour, and the whole concert was about the immigration experience. And that was in, I would say, late October of 1987. And they also had a pair of dancers, Donnie and Eileen Golden, brother and sister, who taught dancing in Brooklyn, and they would come out at the ends of some songs, some tunes, and do the Irish dancing. And that was at least 8-9 years before Riverdance.
Mm, wow.
And at the end of the concert, they were selling LPs, records, for appreciative fans and autographing them. And I went to the show thinking I wanted a certain Mick Maloney album, and I was going to buy it if they had it. But then they performed Kilkelly, and that just blew me away. And I bought that one, and I went up to Robbie O'Connell to get him to autograph, and he said, oh, you bought the tearjerker. And it was a great night. Huh. And those are the memories from Freeborn, especially a lot of the folk shows, because the performers are so happy you're there, and they'll talk to you. And that happens at just about any folk concert, regardless of the venue.
Robin Fox is co-host of the Saturday Morning Folk Show on KDBS. She's sharing her memories from the many decades of Freeborn Hall. We have time for one more story.
Sure.
And let's listen again to the music, and then we'll talk afterwards.
Oh, run, run, Mona, run, bright angels above. Oh, run, run, Mona, run, bright angels above. Oh, run, run, Mona, run, bright angels above. Oh, run, run, Mona, run, bright angels above.
If I had to wait,
bright angels above.
If I had to wait,
bright angels above.
If I just had to wait,
bright angels above.
Oh, if I just had to wait,
bright angels
above.
Sweet Honey in the Rock. They came to Freeborn in the early 90s, and they're such a powerful group. Bernice Johnson Reagan was at that time still the leader. I think she was about 10 years from her retirement, maybe more than that. What I remember most about it was pouring rain, and we got there late, and they were not going to begin their show late, even though there was still at least 50 people to seat. So we had to wait for a break to go inside. Mm-hmm. My friend and I, they were wonderful. They were powerful, and these were all very strong women who told the audience when they could sing along and when it was their turn.
And the audience listened.
Oh, yes. Oh, yes. And of course, one member of their group was Shirley Childress Johnson, who didn't sing at all. She's a sign language interpreter, and I don't know if she's still with the group or not, but she was a complete performer in the group. And that is very different with a lot of, from just about every other performer I've seen.
That song was Run, Mourner, Run.
Yes.
Is the song also called, is there another song called Dennis that's very popular by them?
Oh, there are so many.
Of course.
They have a huge
But that
repertoire.
Was from the Live at Carnegie Hall
right.
album, the band Sweet Honey in the Rock. What was the last concert that you saw? Freeborn Hall's been closed since 2014, but do you remember your last event?
Yes. Dervish and Danu performed together in a show. We were scheduled to see them at the Mondavi Center, and some sort of technical problem happened with the Mondavi, and they shuttled us all over to Freeborn.
Huh.
And it was like memories, and great, this is going to be the last show at Freeborn. This is wonderful. I don't think it hurt anything by going to Freeborn. The acoustics, of course, aren't as good. One of the problems with Freeborn always has been too much space above the stage, so the sound would go straight up and not out into the audience. And much of that was mitigated in the late 80s, mid to late 80s. They did some mitigation work to improve the sound. It reduced some of the seating, but it made for a better concert experience.
Well, I think you're going to be one of these people that looks for a brick or a rock or some piece of the rubble pile when the demolition starts. You have all your memories,
Possibly.
Of course.
We have the memories. We hope that the university finds us space because space is very expensive. And to know that not everybody programs a show based on downloading it from the web somewhere, the computer. We have this amazing library that we don't want to lose. And we have volunteers like crazy to do the physical work, I'm sure, for the move to cut down on costs. But our big worry is space. And that will be interesting.
What's the future, for example, for KDVS, having to move the radio station, the huge music library, all that history to a new location? Any idea yet?
I have not been told anything. For myself, I'm very concerned about the library because our library is amazing. We have, my estimate is 250 to 300,000 volumes in that library. We have cataloged 148,000 so far.
Vinyl?
Vinyl, CDs, 45 vinyl. Wow. Some cassettes, but mostly vinyl and CDs. Mm. When I joined the station in 1982, I was told that it had roughly 20,000. So fast forward 36 years, and thanks to email, the library is huge, and it's a wonderful resource. When I program my show, I take 98% of it from the library because it's much better than my home collection.
Well, again, Freeborn Hall is going to be demolished because the millions and millions, as I understand, more than $37 million that's been projected to retrofit and fix the building was not proven to be cost effective. There are not specific plans at this point yet for the demolishing. It's just known that an institution that's been on the campus is going to be gone.
It's been there for over 60 years, and we have not been told, as far as I know, where we're going. I think they're still trying to find space. It will be interesting to see how things develop.
Robin, thank you for the music, for the memories.
Oh,
nice to have KDVS on our air, too. I really appreciate you being here.
It has been a pleasure. Thank you very much, Beth.
Good luck in the transition, too.
Thanks.
That is Robin Fox from KDVS. There's more at capradio.org/insight, and that's Insight for today. Thanks for joining us.